because a lot of innocent people lost a shit ton full of money, a shit ton full of money, as in it all. And I got a lot of emails and a lot of DMs from people. Some said they listened to me, thank God, and they got out. Some said they wish they would have heard of me and they didn't get out and they lost it all. And that to me is sad. And, you know, it's sad that people lost. I'm happy some people knew about me and listened and got out. But that's the thing where I'm sort of driven, that I couldn't just turn it off because everyone was making such a big deal of the guy. And I thought he wasn't a big deal. I thought he was a clown, schlub, borderline fraud. And as things emerged, I was convinced he was a complete fraud. Convinced.
You're listening to Risk of Ruin. I'm John Reeder. This is episode 32, The Disrespected. I'm recording this episode in late April of 2023, and I need to start off with a refresher, because over the past year, the world has changed in ways that are dramatic, and I think weirdly overlooked. First, let's rewind to April of 2022. This is Sam Bankman-Fried, the former CEO of now bankrupt crypto exchange, FTX, appearing on an episode of the Bloomberg podcast, Odd Lots.
All these like sophisticated firms are like, huh, that's interesting. Like, if the total amount of money in the box is $100 million, then it's going to yield $16 million this year in X tokens being given out for it. That's a 16% return. That's pretty good. We'll put a little bit more in, right? And maybe that happens until there are $200 million in the box. So, you know, sophisticated traders and or people on crypto Twitter or other sort of similar parties go and put $200 million in the box collectively, and they start getting these X tokens for it, right? And now all of a sudden, everyone's like, wow, people just decide to put $200 million in the box. This is a pretty cool box, right? Like, this is a valuable box, as demonstrated by all the money that people have apparently decided should be in the box.
The basic setup of Odd Lots is that they get someone with knowledge of an esoteric part of the economy, and then the guest explains their niche. So Sam Bankman-Fried was explaining crypto staking to the masses. The episode has become infamous because of this exchange where SBF described a Ponzi scheme, and then the Bloomberg host said, you just described a Ponzi scheme.
And then everyone makes money.
I think of myself as like a fairly cynical person, and
yep,
that was so much more cynical than how I would have described farming. Like, you're just like, well, I'm in the Ponzi business and it's pretty good.
Did any of this require any sort of like economic case? It's just like other people put money in the box. And so
the interesting thing about that episode is that abandoning the techno-utopian marketing, which usually accompanies crypto, did not hurt SBF's reputation. Actually, the opposite happened. Over the next few weeks, the world of coins started to unravel. May saw the failure of the stablecoin, UST. Then came the failures of Celsius and Voyager and BlockFi. And yet, as the dominoes toppled in crypto land, the legend of Sam Bankman-Fried grew. He made every magazine cover. He was called the JP Morgan of crypto because as the rest of the market unraveled, he offered to buy some of the failing businesses. The perception of SBF was that he was some kind of financial genius. He'd gone to MIT. He'd worked at Jane Street. He'd reportedly made billions of dollars as the founder of FTX, and also by arbitraging Bitcoin prices across countries. Oh, and he was increasingly being associated with celebrities like Tom Brady and Gisele Bündchen. Although there was one voice who did not buy it. And if you've listened to this podcast, then you might know him. It was Mark Cohodes, the subject of the episode titled Life's Too Short. Mark's very strong opinions are delivered, usually in colorful language, on Twitter. So, through the summer of 2022, while magazines promoted SBF as the next Warren Buffett, there was one guy calling bullshit.
The great thing about this deal is I got no tips, no help, no insiders, no former employees, no nothing. I put one and one and one and one and one together and just said, there's no there. And the more provocative I got on Twitter and speaking out, you know, I was pushing it. You know, I was pushing the RPM line. I was in the red meter. I was in a place of the world where if I was wrong on this thing, I could have been sued. I would have been sued. I mean, it would have been thrown out because he's a public figure, but I could have easily been sued here if I was wrong.
The way that we've framed edges on this show, i.e., what information do you have, which is uniquely yours? Well, that concept is extremely important for this episode. That's why we're talking about it. Because Mark has this knack for turning over the stone that others have ignored. If you want an edge, it's really helpful to be out on an island. So how did Mark end up there?
I just can't let something go. When I hear something is off, I'm attracted to it to try to get to the bottom of it because I sense something is just not right. And my mind, when it gets in that direction, it just can't stop. And when this guy started talking and made such little sense, I started asking around exchange guys what they knew of him, and no one came back and said, he's a friend of so-and-so. He's a friend of this guy. He's so-and-so's, you know, so-and-so mentored him. Everyone came back with a blank, and I started putting it together, and the more I thought about it, the more questions I had. And when a guy like me has more and more questions and no answers, and you can't answer simple questions, there tends to be something there. And then, you know, if he was a minor league player, if he was playing for the Knoxville Lookouts rather than the New York Yankees, it would be like, who cares? But all of this bandy-hoo about this sub-30 guy being worth $20 billion, I'm thinking, that's a lot of money for a guy who I think is a complete imbecile who can't answer any questions.
The legend of SBF probably benefited from the fact that it involved crypto, which traditional finance people both don't understand and also are terrified to admit that they don't understand. And the cornerstone of the SBF myth was a cross-border arbitrage trade that took advantage of disparities in Bitcoin pricing between Korean exchanges and Western exchanges. Although Mark says the SBF story didn't really add up.
That country arbitrage trade, when you really dig into it, it was impossible to do anything he said. It required an inordinate sum of money to pull it off. It required the money to be on site. It required a lot of things that this guy could just never humanly pull off. And no one ever pushed him on it. No one ever asked him a hard question. It was almost like the media was handed a script here on what they could and couldn't talk about.
One of the things we've heard a few times on this podcast, and which comes up a lot when you talk to short sellers, is that they look at the people involved in the company and they ask whether the people involved are really consistent with what the company says they're doing. In the case of FTX, Mark says that they just didn't have the horses to run a serious exchange business. And some of the people not only didn't have the right kind of experience, they had the exact wrong kind of experience. It's now fairly well known that the FTX head of regulatory was a lawyer that had been part of the Ultimate Bet fiasco in the poker world.
This guy and the people around him never had an iota of exchange experience or running anything. And I think I've said in the past that if you check the LinkedIn of everyone associated with this thing, one person is more off the beach than the next. There was no one there who could ever pull it off. And I said early on, you know, this Dan Friedberg needs a look through because he was a poker cheating guy. And I, you know, always opined and said, either FTX is a complete scam and they have the perfect guy as their head of regulatory, or they're just so stupid and have no controls, which makes it a complete scam, to let someone like Friedberg through the door. Because if I was running something like that, you know, especially that needed government approval, Dan Friedberg's the last guy you'd have around. And the fact that he was there for a period of time and was still there after I brought all this stuff up, you know, led to my view how underhanded and dirty this thing was.
If you followed the story of Theranos and Elizabeth Holmes, then you might remember that they claimed this amazing science And yet, scientists had no sway at the company. The board of directors was composed of government and military people. It was like a sleight of hand misdirection trick. Well, if you look at FTX and think about the fact that their celebrity endorsers included Tom Brady, Larry David, Shaq, Kevin O'Leary, it's like, how do these people even fit together? And maybe that's the point. Maybe it's supposed to scramble our brains.
And they were all carrying huge amounts of water for SBF. I mean, they paid Kevin O'Leary $15 million for what? I wouldn't pay that clown a fucking dime to watch my dog or Scaramucci or all these other grifters. I mean, Tom Brady, think of this one. Okay, this is a fact. Tom Brady got screwed because he got a bunch of worthless tokens, right, which tended to be worthless. But his deal with FTX and SBF, Tom Brady was going to get paid more to be an FTX spokesperson than he has made his entire NFL career as a quarterback. They were going to pay him $655 million. That's more than he has made his entire NFL career. You know, and for what? Doing commercials to get Joe Sixpack to invest? I mean, there's blood all over Tom Brady's hands and all these other people, Steph Curry and alike, because they induced, if it's good enough for Tom Brady, it's good enough for me. And so the storm of this thing was so big. It was such a big storm. I said, you know, I've done all these things throughout my life and career. This is really worthy of my attention.
The reason that I want to go step by step through last year's news is because the PR aspect was pretty core to this thing.
I was with my girlfriend. I was with Gretchen Morgenson in Boston, and we were walking for lunch, and I think we saw two of these SBF billboards up, and not necessarily in a great neighborhood of Boston either. And I'm thinking, why would a company like FTX have a billboard of this schlub SBF? I mean, if E-Trade has a billboard, it's about E-Trade. JP Morgan has billboards at Chase. Why would you have it about this guy? It makes no sense because there's nothing special about this guy. And that is, I think, the whole, you know, one of the big things is everyone in society made this guy out to be so great in such this second coming. CNBC, Cartoon Network, I think that clown Scaramucci said he's the JP Morgan of crypto. Well, someone says they're the JP Morgan of crypto. I want to get in the ring and see exactly what JP Morgan has because I think this guy's an idiot. I think he's a fake.
There was a part of the SBF persona, which is interesting to think about in hindsight. He often appeared in public in a t-shirt and shorts wearing New Balance. He has a big mop of curly hair. If you saw him in Starbucks, you might think he was just any guy who plays too many video games. But if you saw him on stage with Gisele Bündchen at an event sponsored by a company he owns, it becomes a different kind of thing. Then he seems like some kind of eccentric savant. Like, no one can tell him to put a tie on because his brilliance can't be contained by our norms. It was Rain Man as a marketing strategy, and this was another thing that most people bought into and Mark didn't buy at all.
And when he was speaking, you know, with President Clinton and Tony Blair and Larry Fink, people like that, the guy was dressed as a schlub. I mean, he was wearing, you know, dirty clothes, shorts, couldn't even comb his hair, couldn't even wash his hair. And fine, you can say the guy's weird, but it's a huge sign of disrespect. And that like really bothered me, how he carried himself in public with people. I mean, you can like Clinton, you can hate Clinton, same thing with Tony Blair. This is a former president of the United States. You show some decency to the event you're in. He always came across in my mind as a nothing. And whenever the media, who I think was completely bought and paid for here, would begin to ask him any form of difficult question, I've said it before, he sort of drives in a figure eight. He never answers it. He talks around it. He smooths through it. But he never answers it. He never answers basic things.
Mark asks around to see if anybody could help him understand SBF. And Mark has been in the markets for 40 years, so he knows a lot of people.
One of the tells, and it's still a tell here, is that most people in this investment business, and let's just say that FTX was in the investment business, people have mentors, or people will have folks who can vouch for you. People will have someone who you first work for, or will go on the record and said this guy was something. I mean, I know I do. I know I have people throughout my life and career who I owe it all to, and I mention them, and I'm still in touch with them to this day. So are other outstanding people. But no one ever came forward to say, this guy was great from the start. He was a genius. He saw things that no one else saw.
Probably some part of Mark's ability to look at this thing in a way that most people couldn't comes down to what you might call short seller intuition. He's wired differently, and he has decades of experience for pattern matching. But it's just not realistic for most people to do that when they don't have his experience. Although there is one thing that should have raised more alarms with the broader world of finance. Through the summer of 2022, crypto was in a complete meltdown with falling prices and failing companies. Anyone who has been in a market crash knows that even the strong don't like to give out their life jackets because they don't know if they'll need that life jacket. And yet, SBF was there offering to rescue everyone.
But I said to myself, interest rates are going up. The stock market is for shit. The retail guy has been getting killed. Trading volume at Coinbase is through the floor. Trading volume everywhere is through the floor. These guys are not Goldman Sachs making all sorts of proprietary trades betting against the customer. These so-called returns, or how these guys do it, is just impossible. And it's absolutely impossible with people who are nothings. I mean, even Warren Buffett has a bad year, or SAC, who got tapped on trading on inside information, he has a bad year. I mean, there's such a thing as bad years, but the macro that was going on against FTX was so huge. For them to say they're doing great, it's just impossible on top of a whole bunch of scenarios that are impossible or were impossible.
I think I should make a point here, which is to draw a circle around the role that cynicism played in the story. Part of the reason it was kind of plausible that SBF was doing well is that in addition to his stake in the FTX exchange, he also had a stake in the hedge fund Alameda Research. It's been reported that in the early days of the exchange, Alameda made up a huge amount of total trading. They were the primary market maker. And people just assumed that Alameda must be using proprietary information from the exchange to front run the exchange's clients. It sounds shady, and when you hear it, you think, wait, that was the reason everyone thought he was doing fine? But I do think that explains a good amount of the willingness to believe. Then, if you think back to SBF's appearance on Oddlots, where he described a Ponzi and the world yawned, you can see that our brains had been rotted from the inside out. Our ability to critically assess the facts had been replaced by an assumption that whatever was going on was probably pretty shady, but as long as he was getting rich, that's totally fine.
And I said to Bloomberg, and I said it to others, why would this guy invest in failing businesses? Why would he try to buy Celsius or Voyager? Or Scaramucci's business was going down the drain. Why would he want to buy him? Because I think he was either collateral damage or he was contagion. And people viewed him as the J.P. Morgan, because if others would have slipped and fell, then he would have been exposed for what he was. So he was trying to take customer money and plug the holes in various dikes where he was basically insolvent from go, because other guys who he was tied to in his scheme were all going under. So if others around him wouldn't have been going under, he could have kept it going. But because there was so much stress in the criminal end of these crypto exchanges, he had to plug those holes, because if he didn't, those other guys would have taken him down.
So crypto world was melting down, and the media was increasingly getting behind the idea that SBF could be the savior of it all. and Mark was increasing his trash talk on Twitter. When it comes to finance trash talkers, there's Mark, and then there is no second place. He's all three spots on the Metal platform. In October alone, Mark mentioned SBF on Twitter 60 times. A typical tweet might be to say that SBF was a complete fake, or Tom Brady should have done his due diligence, or the FTX lawyer, Dan Friedberg, was a problem, or it was just a question of when it blows up, not if it blows up. This kind of thing is not without risk. When Mark was short the pharma fraud, MiMedx, the CEO of the company pulled some political strings, which resulted in the FBI knocking on Mark's door and telling him to stop tweeting about MiMedx. But FTX never responded to any of Mark's tweets.
The fact that they never addressed me, the fact they never reached out to me, you know, all he did was block me on Twitter and his buddies blocked me on Twitter. The fact that they never sent a lawyer letter to me saying, shut the fuck up, you know, you keep talking, we're going to sue you. My lawyer would then say, you better have the facts here because these guys are going to sue you and they got more money than God and it's just not a great look. But the fact that no one pushed back on me and no one threatened me, I kept going even harder. I said, I think I'm really onto something here. Because I would have gone to them and said, okay, real easy, you know, answer my questions and I'll shut the fuck up. But best of my knowledge, you guys aren't able to answer any of my questions. So where did he get the money for the cross country arbitrage? Let me talk to Gary Wang and find out how these guys met in Gary Wang's role in this thing and the due diligence Sequoia did.
Regulators are almost never going to be the ones to find an FTX and address it before people lose all their money. But a very common way that these things get outed is for short sellers and journalists to work together. The short seller might know part of the story, and then they pass it to a journalist who also does some digging. Well, Mark tried to pass his questions to Bloomberg, and they said thanks, but no thanks.
And, you know, I had an experience with Bloomberg in London, where I went to them, their crypto team, with the entire story, and they passed on it, because they said, A, it's bad for business if we did something like this. They actually said that. And then they said, if we go to him with this story, they'll never talk to us again. And I said, but that's your fucking job. You know, that's your job. And I went to them in July, and they blew me off.
If SBF's ascent to national prominence was fast, the implosion of the FTX exchange took place at light speed. On November 2nd, an article was published on CoinDesk which said that the FTX balance sheet was a lot of smoke and mirrors. By the 11th, FTX and Alameda Research and all of the related entities had filed for bankruptcy. You're not going to find a more stunning collapse in terms of the dollars involved and the speed that it took place and the reputation of the main player.
The SEC should have beat me to the punch, so should the DOJ, so should have all these other guys. But for some reason, these people who have thousands and thousands and thousands of employees, A, don't do shit, or B, they're slower than shit, or C, they're so co-opted and paid off and or politicked out of the game that nothing can happen. And then there's, you know, then there's little old me, you know, where I just, you know, do my thing.
The bankruptcy filing left unanswered questions, including an important one like, how much money was missing? There were big numbers floating around, billions of dollars. I mean, this all happened 6 months ago, and there are still big questions as to what exactly happened. But the most likely explanation is that SBF's hedge fund treated the exchange like a piggy bank, used those funds to trade, and didn't follow normal margin requirements. So when the market collapsed, there was a hole that was too big to be plugged. Mark has been a short seller for almost his entire career, but oddly, he found SBF and FTX at a time when he'd sworn off short selling. I mean, it's a tough business, and Mark has had some very negative personal experiences as a result, so he had kind of given it up. It is kind of interesting that he got involved in this with no real way to trade it, and at a time when he didn't think he was a short seller anymore.
And when people kept telling me, I was wrong, you can't make any money, it's a waste of your time, things like that, it actually motivated me more because the chaos could be so big. It could be so big. And you know, people criticize me because I'm a short seller. Fine, I'm a short seller. So if I'm short a stock and it works, I make money. Great. I'm entitled to make money. Great. But I said to myself, there's no way to play this. So wouldn't it be something if I contributed to the takedown of this guy and I didn't even make a dime? Then what would everyone say?
The events that followed the FTX bankruptcy filing are almost unbelievable to think about, even though I know they happened. Sam Bankman-Fried, facing an almost sure criminal indictment, did what no defendant should ever do. He started talking, and he wasn't particularly careful about who he talked to. He talked to people with a YouTube channel. He went on Twitter Spaces. I mean, it is really bonkers to think about. But I guess he had just come off a year of fawning media attention, and maybe he thought he could finesse his way through it. In any case, one of the things he started talking about was the role that bank accounts played in muddying the water between the exchange and the hedge fund.
At that time, we were trying to get bank accounts for FTX. We couldn't. We eventually did, you know, a few years later. But, you know, 2019, 2020, we couldn't get bank accounts that could take customer deposits for FTX. We obviously were operating crypto wallets and, you know, had crypto deposits and withdrawals. But some customers, you know, generally ones that had, in many cases, sort of like foreseen relationships OTC with Alameda, would wire money to Alameda Research, asking to be credited to their FTX account. And they'd wire it straight to Alameda. And then we would do a ledger transfer on FTX, effectively from Alameda to that to whoever sent that wire transfer in order to credit them.
We now know the bank accounts that SBF referenced in that Twitter Spaces were probably at Silvergate Bank. Various of the SBF entities had accounts there, and it's not clear anyone cared whether the accounts were properly used. One of the bank accounts that SBF created was for a fake electronics retailer called North Dimension, and then they used that account to receive funds for the FTX exchange. So accounts at Silvergate Bank were right in the middle of one of the biggest ripoffs that anyone can remember.
I found Silvergate after FTX blew up. I knew what Silvergate was. I knew they were involved in it. I knew FTX was his biggest customer. But I didn't really have any interest in Silvergate till FTX blew up. And after FTX blew up, the guy who runs Silvergate, you know, you start looking into him, Alan Lane, and they started putting out these bogus press releases how they have no effect on them. They don't have money loaned to them, but they're their biggest customer. And you start looking at their customer list, and it's one criminal exchange after another. And I said, this is for me. This is, you know, I can't miss this. And the guy was on the Cartoon Network, aka CNBC, and he pictured himself in the backdrop where all sorts of religious artifacts on the wall. And next to wigs, you know, posing in religion is always a problem. So I said, I have to start doing some work on the Silvergate, and it's been fascinating. It's been wonderful. It's been something else. So I wouldn't know about Silvergate if not for FTX.
When Silvergate ended up on the list of heavily shorted companies, they seemed to understand that wasn't great. But their response was like they asked an intern to Google what to do when you're being attacked by short sellers. Their press releases were half-assed. They tried to offer language that gave them some plausible deniability, but it was all very weak sauce.
Yeah, I started shorting Silvergate in the high 50s and really got involved when he started blaming the short sellers on Twitter, which I think was me, and then getting on CNBC and putting out his bogus press releases and all this other crap. Then I really got going, because this guy is, Alan Lane is a boob of all boobs. And I do think Alan Lane is going to go the way of Parker Petit. I do think Alan Lane's going to end up in prison one day. I really do.
Mark says that he thinks a lot about who he's up against when he gets involved in this stuff.
When I go after something, I say, who is the key man who can beat me here? Who is worth a shit? frankly, no one at Silvergate is worth a shit. No one at Signature's worth a shit. They're all clowns. And there's no big time guy, right? Which is why I never short Tesla or Elon Musk. I don't need to fuck with Elon Musk when all these bumblers are floating around. That's the big mistake these guys made. Why be short someone who's extraordinary, someone who's protected, someone who's smart, someone who the government needs to keep in business, someone who is the 1 to 4 richest man in the earth? I don't need that. I'll pick on the weak, the bumblers, the frauds, the crooks, the people who can't answer questions, the people who are criminals, people who beat women up, people who are mean to kids, people like that. That's my speed.
According to CEO Alan Lane, the match between Silvergate and the crypto world was serendipitous. Silvergate was a small bank looking for deposits at exactly the same time that crypto companies needed some bank, any bank, that would do business with them. These are comments the CEO made on the Pomp podcast.
And so I learned that there were companies that were raising venture money. So they had deposits. Mm-hmm. They wanted to put them in a bank, Silvergate's bank. And they were getting kicked out of their banks. And so obviously there was a reason they were getting kicked out, and it was the perception of risk. And if you think about companies that were being formed at the time, you know, example I use often is Coinbase, mm-hmm. right? So Coinbase is a money transmitter and money service business. And so they were struggling to find bank accounts because lots of banks were kind of just, they were leaving that segment. So mm-hmm. that was one reason. The other reason was because of the whole concern about anti-money laundering, BSA, mm-hmm. And that really has more to do with kind of terrorist financing, you know, bad actors, and you know, it was right around that time that Silk Road happened, right? Yep. And so big concern that the primary use case for Bitcoin at the time was for, you know, nefarious activity.
So Silvergate knew from the outset that what they were doing was not something other banks were interested in. Here's Mark again.
And they have this sleepy bank in La Jolla with 4 branches doing shitbag loans, tanning salons and strip malls, crap like that, doing some mortgages. Just a nothing business with $40 to $50 million in deposits. Just nothing. Just a sleepy shit-ass bank. And this Barry Silbert came by and encouraged them to get into crypto. Basically said, we need a crypto bank, a.k.a. we need a drug mule to carry the drugs. And Barry Silbert convinced Alan Lang that these guys should get involved in crypto in the SEN network. And they probably said, you know, we're in tight with this guy. We're in tight with that guy. We'll make sure nothing happens. And if this works, you'll become richer beyond your wildest dreams. You know, because right now you're going nowhere. You got nothing. You got 4 branches. You make shitty loans. You have a nothing career. You're a nothing guy.
Having a bank that provides plumbing to the crypto world is pretty important. It's like, if you want to buy Bitcoin, you can't magically snap your fingers and turn dollars into coins. There has to be some mechanism in the traditional finance world to make that happen. Until Bitcoin is accepted everywhere, then you need to be able to move from Bitcoin to dollars and vice versa. It requires infrastructure, and Silvergate was part of that infrastructure. They operated an exchange called the SEN Network, which promised 24/7 ability to transfer between customers.
So he figures, why not? Why not get involved and create this SEN Network? Because if it works, I'll make $50 to $200 million and no one will be the wiser, right? And for a long time it worked. I mean, the stock went from 7 to what, 150, 200, something like that. And these guys actually thought they were something. But all they were was a money launderer, a criminal enterprise for the worst of the worst across the world. Every one of these SEN network customers that I can tell is beyond shady. I mean, my lawyer's not going to let me use certain words on certain things, but they are beyond shady. And one after the other, after a brother, after a mother, they've all failed or in the process of failing. And I think crypto, and the reason I'm so involved in the Silvergate, to take this piece of shit bank down and also Signature Bank is that crypto here is just the shiny object. These two banks are worldwide money laundering operations. Silvergate through the SEN network and Signature through the Signet network. Yeah, crypto is involved here. And yeah, crypto is dirty and these exchanges are illegal, run by crooks. But it's really enabled the worst of the worst to launder money through these things 24/7, 365 through every dirty country on the planet. And that's the real story here. These two banks, real story in my mind, and I'm highly confident it will eventually come out. These two banks have been used to launder money for terrorists, drugs, human trafficking, just the worst of the worst.
Alan Lane used to say that Silvergate had a compliance-first culture, but this is like political spin, or maybe it's a punchline. Because one of Silvergate's customers was the world's largest crypto exchange, Binance. Well, the CFTC recently sued Binance for ignoring U.S. regulations, and in the complaint, they showed internal messages where exchange employees treated anti-money laundering requirements as a joke. They literally said in internal messages that their customers were there for crime. And Binance would identify an account that was obviously engaged in illicit activity, and they would say roughly, "We need to shut down this account. It's too obvious that the funds are shady, but they can just open another account." Again, they were not serious about complying with U.S. regs. Also, I should point out that if you hooked most people in the crypto world up to a lie detector and asked them whether any of these companies should have to comply with U.S. law, they would admit the truth. They are planning for a future where crypto companies don't have to comply with U.S. law. And so Alan Lane's claim that Silvergate had a compliance-first culture doesn't pass the laugh test.
If they were to try to get a loan, invest in a private company, buy out a business, do anything, these banks are up your ass so hard it's not even funny because of AML, KYC stuff. They need your driver's license. They need utility bills. They need everything, right? But Silvergate can just go and launder money throughout the world through criminals, through businesses that don't even exist, and still have a stock.
If you follow these things on Twitter, it doesn't take long to figure out who has their facts and who doesn't, who does original work, and who just regurgitates the work of others. One of the accounts that provided actionable info is Aurelius Value. Compared to Mark, he's like a silent killer. He just kept delivering information that proved up the short case, like a document showing that South American money launderers had been using accounts at Silvergate to transmit hundreds of millions of dollars.
I'm not acting alone here. You know, James Gibson, a.k.a. Aurelius, has done a ton of legwork and deserves as much credit on this Silvergate as anybody. The guy has busted his ass, and I know him from our MyMedics days, but he's as outraged on all this bullshit as I am. And I trust him, and I think the guy is nothing short of outstanding. And he doesn't swing as sharp as axe as me, and he's not as nasty, and he has little kids. But you know, there are people who have spent thousands and thousands of hours on this, working on this, and it's complex, it's hardy, and it is needle moving when it eventually happens. It's something.
Before our interview, Mark sent me a letter that he had provided to a number of regulators. It was 15 pages. It detailed all of the evidence showing that Silvergate did not and could not take their Know Your Customer requirements seriously.
The people who matter in this country, the regulators or law enforcement, they all have this, right? And they've all had it. They've all had it since somewhere around January 15th. January 15th, the first one went out. And then, and I keep sending it and I keep updating it and things like that. So no one can say they weren't warned. And yet, as you say, the stock still trades. And clowns and stock manipulators like Zero Hedge, you know, keep trying to orchestrate short squeezes in the shares because they think they can make money squeezing shorts. But that's not the issue. The issue is this bank should not be in business. This bank should be raided. This bank should be seized. Alan Lane should be in prison. Because what they do is they go through the United States banking system to launder money for criminals.
I will say that Mark is pretty fun to follow on Twitter because he is so relentless when he gets onto something. But if you overly focus on Mark's hot takes, then you are going to miss the substance of his claims. The letter that he sent to regulators had 86 footnotes. It just methodically presented accusations along with the accompanying proof. He didn't just leave it at, this is a crypto bank, crypto's screwed, therefore the bank is a zero.
Because the book value, which stands at, let's say, $12 right now, half of it is a deferred tax asset, which no one can use. That gets you to $6. And they have $2 billion of loans out, right? Loans, which are shitty loans. And I think those loans are probably worth between 50 and 70 cents on the dollar. So 70 cents is a $600 million hit. There's 35 million shares. $600 million hit is 20, right? They only have a book of 12. So that gets you to negative 8. The deferred tax asset's not worth a shit. That gets you to negative 14. So I think this thing has negative enterprise value.
The peak price of Silvergate stock was about $200 a share. The first time I talked to Mark, the price was $15 a share. But Mark was pretty confident that Silvergate was headed down the drain. His endgame was something like an FDIC brokered deal for the bank.
They're set, the SEN network, which they have, is the money laundering network. And they don't have the deposits anymore to run a bank. And the rating at Moody's, the rating at Moody's right now for their deposits is lower than when Washington Mutual was forced brokered into oblivion. So anyone who has more than $250,000 at Silvergate is looking for trouble. So if the rates you pay on your deposits are higher than the money you're loaning out and you're a bank, or your NIM, your net interest margin, falls below a certain level, you just go out of business. Banks fail, and banks fail all the time. And how I think this thing ends is you're going to wake up one day, probably a Monday morning, and the headline is going to be, Wells Fargo buys out Silvergate. San Francisco, California. Wells Fargo today agreed to buy the assets and common shares of Silvergate Bank at 13 cents a share. That's 13 cents, John. Wells Fargo will assume up to $200 million of liabilities, right? And will close this, and this, right? Silvergate will be closed in San Diego. Wells Fargo doesn't view this acquisition as material in any way. Basically, the FDIC is going to go to someone and say, we need you to wind down this bank. Head of Wells Fargo will say, this bank is worthless. That's right. You're paying 13 cents for it, right? You'll pay $4 million for the fucking bank, right? But we need you to manage the wind down because all hell's breaking loose here.
I recorded with Mark, and I was starting to do some of the editing work, although I thought I had some time. The battles with these shorts can drag out. Then one day, while I was working on the episode, Silvergate said they wouldn't be able to file their annual report on time. The stock lost 50% in a day. The next few days got even worse. One by one, the bank's crypto clients said they were leaving the SEN network. Then Silvergate just shut down the SEN. It was like the only reason for this bank to exist, and it was gone. Then there were reports that the FDIC was on site in La Jolla. Finally, Silvergate announced that it would voluntarily shut down. As of the recording of this episode, the stock is about $1.30. I don't know if I need to say this, but I hope that no one listens to this episode and then goes and shorts Silvergate at $1.30. I mean, I never want anyone to ever trade anything based on what they hear on this podcast. We are talking about how to think about edges. I'm never giving out any kind of financial advice. Anyway, from the time I first talked to Mark until now, the stock is down 90%+.
Silvergate is a criminal operation. Signature Bank is a criminal operation. I set out on both those names to destroy the SEN network, which is the Silvergate Exchange Network, which laundered over $1 trillion in its history through its system. They didn't launder the full trillion, but a lot of it they did. And Signet, which is the Signature Network, similarly $1 trillion. So these guys laundered $1 trillion each for the world's worst financial criminals out there. And I am pleased, pleased that my efforts, along with others, went to shutting these things down. So these banks didn't fail because of banks or run on the banks or deposits or mismatch. They failed because they were and are criminal operations, flat up. So to deflect and say it was because of crypto, none of these things ever had anything to do with legitimate crypto. Their customers were criminals. So to say it's crypto is just a joke.
After Silvergate and Signature were down the toilet, there emerged a narrative in the crypto universe that these banks would still be around, still viable businesses, but for the underhanded actions of U.S. regulators. If you've ever seen a sports team lose a playoff game and the fans cope with that loss by claiming that it wasn't just bad refs that cost them the game, but a league-wide conspiracy against their team, well, it was kind of like that.
Silvergate failed because of the SEN network and what they did and who they catered to, as did Signature. And I know what happened. And I know the contents of my letters. And I know what's going on as we speak. So everyone who wants to opine and say, you know, run on the bank, deposits, all this bullshit, it's just wrong. It's just wrong. And they don't know. But again, there's a lot of people who drive in the fast lane who got their driver's license last night.
The idea that somehow the U.S. government rigged the game and picked out some banks to kill is even more funny when you consider that when FTX failed, a common refrain from the reeling crypto world was, where were the regulators?
I think the government and the regulators now are off their asses and well awake. And now that they have SBF, I think the next one is Binance, and the one after Binance is Tether. I think they're going to go up the food chain and basically go after all these guys who are nothing short of criminals. And I think they're going to go up the food chain. I think they're going to take their time. I think they're building cases, and I think there's going to be a progression here. And I think, you know, again, I have no opinion or thought on Bitcoin or Ethereum. But I do think all these coins these guys came with were all mechanisms to pump and dump to make themselves wealthy to screw Joe Sixpack. And I think that concept's going to come home to roost. It's going to take some time, but I think it's going to come home to roost. I think Cross River Bank, which is private, has major problems. I think there's significant problems in the ecosystem. And again, I don't know exactly the timing of things. I don't really care. I don't have bets down. Again, it's my opinion, but I will do what I can to make the world better and expose whatever of these scam artists I can.
To summarize the story thus far, FTX failed. Mark was on it, trying to warn people months before the exchange declared bankruptcy. The FTX blast radius ended up turning two banks into dust. Mark was short Silvergate and Signature Bank, but all of that was a precursor for what's happened in the markets since. Regional banks have been under incredible pressure, and the biggest name in the headlines was Silicon Valley Bank. They opened for trading on Wednesday, March 8th, with a stock price of $267 a share, and you probably know by now that they didn't even make it to the end of Friday.
A year ago, probably January or February, Silicon Valley Bank was my biggest short. It was my biggest short. And it was in the 600s. And they had a funky quarter. And I was under margin pressure due to my Carvana short, where the brokers were changing haircuts on me. So Silicon Valley broke, and I covered it, which was a clear violation of everything I do and everything I stand for. So I covered it probably in the 400s. And I made some money, but I never returned to the crime scene. So I'm literally kicking the living shit out of myself for not getting back in into Silicon Valley Bank. So I wasn't short Silicon Valley Bank during all the fireworks, but I had the setup in this thing perfectly. But I screwed it up because I can only really spend mentally so much time on so many things and be focused. And I focused on Carvana, and then I focused, you know, then I had my arm injury. Then I focused on FTX, and I just lost track of Silicon Valley Bank. So I could absolutely shoot myself for missing this thing. Shoot myself. But I missed it. But I missed it. So I don't want anyone to think that, one, I'm invincible, two, I'm perfect. I still make an awful lot of mistakes. But this one really bothers me. Last year I had an outstanding year. I mean, I was up just a ridiculous sum, but you know, I know I can't get them all, and I know I can't hit them all, but my expectation internally for myself is I can.
I have to point out something about the failure of Silicon Valley Bank, which is either ironic or perfectly fitting, depending on how you want to look at it. FTX and Sam Bankman-Fried rose to prominence with the help of perhaps the most storied name in venture capital. Sequoia had invested in FTX, and they also contributed to the myth of SBF. They had an article on their website wondering if SBF would be the first trillionaire. So VCs funded and promoted FTX, which caused a series of dominoes to fall, and ultimately took down the institution that had been the preferred bank for venture-backed companies. And the VCs also had a role in the failure of Silicon Valley Bank. Generally, the bank went down because of bad decisions. Specifically, the bank went down because VCs created a panic among the depositors. During its last week in business, the bank's executives had a call with their prominent customers and said, "Hey guys, as long as you all don't panic, we're going to be okay." And the venture capitalists, who had done business with the bank for years and who told all of their portfolio companies to bank there, were like, "Yeah, fuck these guys." Everyone bolted for the exits at the same time, and that was it. Then many of the same VCs that had been part of the stampede realized, "Oh, wait, a lot of our portfolio companies still have money that's stuck there. That's not great." Under normal rules of order, those deposits would have been facing a haircut, maybe 5% loss, maybe 10% loss. No one really knows. So the loudest voices in the VC world spent a solid weekend promoting panic and chaos in the US banking system. It was like, imagine a guy whose house is on fire, and he thinks that if he starts throwing Molotov cocktails at his neighbor's houses too, the fire department might show up a little faster. To the extent that the All In podcast is the mouthpiece for the VC world, the fear and chaos was led by All In podcast hosts David Sachs and Jason Calacanis. And I will point out that these guys spend a decent amount of time promoting economic Darwinism and the survival of the fittest. The attitude they sell is that they are the victors of the Thunderdome. But Mark says these guys aren't the product of Thunderdome. He has a different cultural reference for David Sachs and crew.
I think of them as Josie and the Pussycats. I think these guys are just young children walking around, you know, Sachs, Jason, Chamath. These guys have confused a bull market with brains. And I think the three of them all need to be held accountable. And if I have my way and, you know, my work concludes what I think I have, hopefully the regulators and the authorities will be after these guys and their brethren. Because what I think has gone on in the VC community as it relates to the pump and dumps that these guys have done, their brethren in the VC community have done, their ties to FTX and SBF, their ties to all of this subterranean shit wealth transfer that's gone on from Joe Spit Sixpack to themselves, it's simply disgusting. And when you overlay that to the role of the mainstream media promoting these guys as they're the second coming, it's just beyond sickening. And the thing that's just beyond is it takes a fellow like me who doesn't have a fund, who doesn't have a firm, who doesn't get money from anybody, who does it myself, to speak out against these asshats and raise awareness. And that's the key. Raise awareness on what really goes on. And the reason the mainstream media can't touch me and wants nothing to do with me is because I make people think.
When the All In podcast crew amazingly got religion on the role that government should play in free markets, they ended up on the business end of Mark's tweets. They tried to rationalize their newfound love of bailouts. Mark called bullshit, and even Nassim Taleb joined in. It was hilarious. It was like exactly what you would want from Twitter beef.
Josie and the Pussycats immediately went under their mama's dress looking for help from something called the free market. All these guys, you know, this includes Ackman, all these so-called, in air quotes, billionaires, are all the result of easy money, lax regulation, and the government looking the other way. The second there's the slightest bit of trouble, and this includes the commercial real estate guys, Sternlicht, and all these other guys, the second there's trouble, all these guys are looking for the government to bail them out. So you can have it one way or you can have it the other, but you can't really have it both ways.
Let me try to provide a little more detail on what I think Mark is getting at with some of this stuff. I will just use the Bird Scooter Company as an example. These are the scooters that you've probably seen littering public sidewalks. A few years ago, they were heralded as the fastest company to achieve a $1 billion valuation. Also, David Sachs was one of the VC investors, and he promoted the company on various podcasts. Well, Bird went public in 2021 with an initial valuation of more than $2 billion. But since then, the company has had net losses, which completely eclipse their total revenues. I mean, it's not even close. They've also admitted that the financials they filed when they went public cannot be relied upon. It turns out that they were booking revenue they never expected to collect, which is sort of frowned upon. Also, the business model is based on this assumption that local regulations can't possibly account for the brilliance of a transportation disruptor that just dumps garbage scooters on the public sidewalk. When Bird exited the San Francisco market, they had run up $1 million in fines. That's just one city. Today, the shares trade for about 15 cents. It went from market cap in the billions to a market cap in the tens of millions. The CEO of Bird is a former Uber and Lyft guy, and before that, he was one of the first employees at a company called Yammer, which was run by, wait for it, David Sachs. So if I say that this is a company born of the ethos of Silicon Valley, I don't think that's really in dispute, right? It fits a broader trend. Little regard for regulations, poor controls, constant pressure to juice the valuation of the company, and then when there are no VCs left to mark up the value in private rounds, take the whole thing public and dump it on retail investors, the bag holders of last resort. The problem is not that Bird was a bad bet gone wrong. That happens all the time. And on this podcast, we actually don't judge bad bets gone wrong. The thing I am trying to draw a circle around is that VC culture creates exactly this kind of company. If you see one of them and note the characteristics of that one, you might be able to find more of them.
And these guys are complete scum of the earth. They may claim they're worth $1 billion. I'd submit they've done nothing for society except cost people money, make society worse, and encourage criminality. And people may love me, great. They may hate me, totally fine. But I at least expose the bad elements for what they are. And hopefully, numerous people will go to prison, including SBF, Alan Lane, CEO of Silvergate, Sachs for what he did with Solana, Chamath on some of these SPACs, Jason Calacanis, all these guys. I mean, they all need to be called out and held accountable. And their grandstanding and gaslighting in light of this Silicon Valley bank stuff is just beyond rich. Because clearly they were tipped. Clearly they and Theo encouraged the bank run. Clearly, they had sweetheart deals from the bank. Clearly, what went on is untoward. And hopefully, the government gets after these guys and makes examples of them. They won't have me on their podcast. They won't address me. The best they can do is attempt to try to block me on Twitter. But as you know, all that does is motivate me more. And a motivated me, if I'm on your case, is not really where you'd want me to be if I were them. But I'm on this David Sachs's case. I think this guy is as phony as a $3 bill, and he's a chicken shit, and he tries to hide with politics or his reverse rhetoric or his gaslighting. I don't really care. I think he's a pussy. I think he's a fake. I think he's done nothing for society. And we'll see how it all plays out. I would not want to be him. And that's not a threat. So don't think he can get me blocked or anything like that. You know, Joe's, you know, spent $1.4 million for a 50th birthday or 40th birthday party for himself. And anyone who wants to spend $1.4 million throwing yourself a birthday party, I don't think deserves a handout as he gores Joe Sixpack. So I think he's going to have a problem with that fucking populist narrative of his.
The other thing the VC world has done in recent years is to fund crypto companies. And then in exchange, VCs get a crypto token, sometimes at a discount. And unlike their shares of the company, which they have to wait for an IPO to sell, they can dump these tokens after fairly short lockups.
Venture capital back in the day used to be you find a good company or something that can grow with an exciting management team. And you do series A, B, C, D rounds, right? And it takes time and it's high risk and 80% fail, but you do come up with the Googles and the Apples and the Adobes of the world. You do come up with them. And that's how Silicon Valley was built. It was built through venture capital, people putting risk money in these series A, B, C, D, E, whatever rounds, going public and the companies becoming big. That's how the model works. Now, when interest rates started going up and the economy started being less good and things like that started to happen, when that started to go, a lot of those companies failed and were going to fail. So this VC industry, the Silicon Valley guys, if you will, decided that it would be great or it would be best to come with these coins, come with these tokens, issue themselves to themselves at 4 cents, the GP at 10 cents, their LPs at a dollar, and then bringing these things out through the FTX network, getting Joe Sixpack excited, marking these things up, making fortunes to watch the rug pull out from under these things. That's what's gone on. So the VC community has migrated from this creating great new emerging growth companies to running these scams with these coins and with these fake companies to induce people to play. That's the problem. That's what's gone on. That's what's so fucking troubling. That's what bothers me so damn much. And I think it needs to stop and it needs to be exposed.
If you listen to the episode of the podcast about the Twitter merger, then you might remember that Elon Musk's core claim was that the site was overrun by bots and the user numbers were fake. Well, two of the people who carried water for Elon during that time were David Sachs and Jason Calacanis. They were loyal soldiers on their podcast and on Twitter. They helped to spread and promote Elon's claims. And I have to point out that if you had believed them, then you would have also had to believe that Twitter was a massive fraud with huge implied liabilities from future advertiser lawsuits. But would you be surprised to know that Sachs and Calacanis also reportedly invested in the private Twitter, the same company they'd spent months implicitly accusing of fraud? You can say that all is fair in love and war, and these guys were just banging the drum to get a discount on their investment, but I would counter that they also showed they were willing to use their megaphones to spread bullshit. And if you combine this willingness to spew garbage with the kinds of companies that have entered the public markets as a result of this crowd, maybe a trend starts to emerge.
I think conceptually, if you can find shorts that evolve around the Silicon Valley-based VC community and their upcoming comeuppance, I think that'll be pretty interesting. I think that crew is in for it now for a while. If we were to bet that, I think it's going to be a lot harder of a go for the Thiels, Andreessen Horowitz, you know, Josie and the Pussycat crowd as time goes forward.
I think we can stop beating a dead horse as it relates to the world's loudest venture capitalists, because I want to wrap up and talk about Mark being Mark. He's one of the true originals. This is the second episode I've made with him, and he's unlike any other guest.
People like me or love me because I'm brash and I have results. People hate me because I'm brash.
I also just want to reiterate that nothing in this episode should be construed as advice. I think that Mark's points are really valuable, but they're valuable because they show how he thinks.
I say none of it's investment advice, but whenever you talk, people take you seriously. But I say never short a stock, never try this at home. This is dangerous stuff. I have money where my mouth is. I'm not asking for any money, but here are my points of view. And this should just be a starting point for you to do whatever you do. I make mistakes. If I make a mistake, I say I'm sorry. If you like Anavex and Anavex doesn't work, I say I'm sorry and we'll congratulate the shorts. No one has more at stake than me.
The whole idea in attempting to do any of this is that you will be able to develop an opinion that is uniquely yours and which is also correct. And so I think it's really cool that we have access to Mark, who is prolific at developing unique opinions. Although that also means he's not for everyone.
So at some point, people will learn their fucking lesson and leave me alone. But until then, I just keep going. So the trash talk will continue. And the people who love it, love it. People who hate it, hate it. I'm up to 19,000 people blocked on Twitter. And that can fill up Madison Square Garden full of haters. So it is what it is. The mainstream media disrespects me. Bloomberg disrespects me by not running my SBF thoughts. I view this disrespect as very thick. And that motivates me to do better. So the fact that Sachs doesn't want me on his podcast, Joe Rogan doesn't want me on, major media doesn't want me on, no one wants to cover what I've done, fine.
Mark says that there's no greater motivator than disrespect. And it is true that you can look at the things he's done in his career and think he has no reason to feel disrespected, right? If you find Sam Bankman-Fried, and then that puts you onto Silvergate Bank, and you short it from the high 50s until all that's left is the pens from the lobby, no one can take that from you.
You know, people close to me say you should take time and reflect and look at what you've done over your career and things like that. And I said, I'm still, you know, I'm doing better now than I did 5 years ago or 10 years ago or 15 years ago. And I'll be 63 in June. So I'm still operating at a high level. And I just want to sort of say this, and I think people need to reflect about it. You know, Chanos is my friend, and I've known him forever. But his last great thing was Enron, and that was 20-something years ago. And he's still living, and people are talking about him for what he did in Enron 20-some-odd years ago. Well, since that, I've done Concordia, which was a Canadian drug fraud, HomeCap, a Canadian financial fraud, which almost took subprime down there. I've done my medics, and I've done the big three, which is FTX, Silvergate, and Signature. And this is with a firm. I don't have a firm, and I don't have people working for me or things like that. And I've done this single-handedly. And no one will ever take down three companies like that again in my lifetime. Back to back to back, three light tower shots out of the park. And people may want to say trash talk, and yeah, I trash talk, but I fucking back it up. And I back it up in a really big way. And I do some of the trash talk, and it creates something called Cahoda's derangement syndrome, and it drives these guys who I'm after wild because they know I'm on to them. Pete Petit knew I got him. And Alan Lane, CEO of Silvergate, knew I had him. And the signature guys, of course, knew I had them. And SBF knew I had them. So when I get somebody and I get someone in my clutches, they know I got them and they don't know how to react.
Mark's hat trick might have only happened due to an unlikely accident last year. He was working with one of his horses and got seriously injured.
I broke my humerus into numerous pieces last year. I put my shoulder into seven pieces last year. It got screwed together, plated together. And I just said, you know, here we go. And the pain was so excruciating, I almost passed out. And I'm so not addicted to crap. I never took one pain pill for my injury. I just took out my frustration on these motherfuckers, on SBF, on Silvergate, on Signature.
If you go back and listen to some of the other episodes, I think you'll hear a lot of stories about people taking the thing that makes them different, some way that they don't exactly fit in, and then channeling that difference into an edge. I guess in some ways, that's what this podcast is about.
Because again, as we've said, I'm not a Stanford guy or a Harvard guy or a Yale guy. All these guys, including Sachs, are all highly educated, right? Stanford or USC or whatever fucking bullshit degrees, right? Everyone went to the greatest of schools. I didn't. My grades sucked. And everyone's doubted me my entire fucking life. And everyone said I can't, but I knew I can. And I knew I can get it done. And I believe in myself to the highest order.
Risk of Ruin is written and produced by me. A very special thanks to Mark Cahotas for doing this episode. You can follow Mark on Twitter at AlderlaneEggs. As a reminder, I've started a Substack to stay in touch with listeners. I'll put a link to that newsletter in the show notes. If you want to get in touch with the show, you can email riskofruinpod@gmail.com. You can also follow us on Twitter at halfkelly.